I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with Ron Lindsay. Ron is a PhD and JD. He has a doctorate in bioethics, so quite appropriate for our program. He's now the director, CEO of the Center for Inquiry, which is a humanist think tank associated with Paul Kurtz's other many endeavors and the Council for Secular Humanism, and works out of Washington, D.C. Welcome, Ron Lindsay.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking today about your book, Future Bioethics, Overcoming Taboos, Myths, and Dogmas. As you say yourself, it's exhaustively researched and vigorously argued, and I agree with that assessment.
Well, thank you so much. And it has received some favorable reviews from the online version of Publishers Weekly, which agreed with that assessment. And I was also happy that the editor for the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal, Carol Mason Spicer, who's well-known in her field and well-respected, also praised it and indicated it should be must-reading, I think. I'm paraphrasing her, for policymakers in Washington. So,
excellent. Which people like us may have a little bit more sway with in the coming period.
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk about that first for a second. We are in a period now where both in economic policy and in the culture wars, people of progressive secular points of view are going to have a heck of a lot more influence. So we're in a political opening. What do you see as the biopolicy questions that are going to be at the top of the agenda in the next year or so? I mean, you talk about a number of different things in this book. You talk about legalizing physician-assisted aid to dying. You talk about conscientious objection of healthcare employees, the food wars, enhancement, which is near and dear to my heart, embryonic stem cell research. For instance, just to get the conversation started, I don't see embryonic stem cell research as really that much of a culture war issue anymore. I think that it's been transcended.
I think to some extent you're right. First of all, no matter which person is elected, of the leading candidates, of course, either McCain or Obama, both have expressed their support in some manner. I mean, there are differences between them, but they both support embryonic stem cell research. And, of course, with recent advances in the field, some might argue that we don't need to put so much emphasis on embryonic stem cell research. I tend to think that certainly those who say that the whole issue of embryonic stem cell research and its morality and whether we need to invest money in it is now a moot issue given recent developments, I tend to disagree with that. I'm certainly very pleased by some of the developments that indicate, for example, that we can take regular skin cells and essentially turn the clock back so they become the equivalent of embryonic stem cells. To some extent has mooted the controversy over using actual embryos as a source for those stem cells, but not entirely, because I think most researchers agree that the most prudent approach would, of course, be to continue with embryonic stem cell research while pursuing these other alternatives, just like you would do in any other area of research. You don't put all your eggs, so to speak, in the proverbial one basket. You want to pursue different avenues. So I think we definitely should continue with embryonic stem cell research. So those who oppose it, I think, will still have an issue with it. But the good news for those who are progressive, as you say, is that I think whatever administration comes into power in 2009, we're likely to see approval of legislation. Of course, Congress has already approved legislation indicating that federal government should fund embryonic stem cell research. The difference this time is I think we'll have a president that will not veto that.
I confess something I was expecting to see more of in your book, and which I didn't see there, was an argument for a distinctive secular approach to ethics. Now, part of the reason, I think, is because up until very recently, most bioethicists were secular people and used Enlightenment rationales for their ethics. But we've been engaged in 8 years of trench warfare with Christian right activists and now bioethicists, people from religious bioethics backgrounds, over these issues. And so don't you think it's important to reassert the importance of secular Enlightenment values as the basis for our ethics?
Well, I agree completely, and I think maybe I was too subtle in my argument. Certainly, if you didn't pick up on it, I was too subtle. I do indicate right in the introduction that this is not a polemic against religion or anything like that, because this is not a book about metaphysics. It's about ethics. And there are bioethicists who are religious and have contributed to the field, but to the extent they've contributed to the field, it's because they've left aside religious dogma when it comes to asserting arguments. And as indicated by my subtitle, I believe very strongly that progress in bioethics has been blocked, unfortunately, by resort to dogma, myths, and taboos. And obviously, the most clear path to circumventing those obstacles is to rely on a secular bioethics. And by that, I mean a bioethics that any person can assess, a bioethics that's based on fact and reasoned argument and not on appeal to religious dogma or, as I emphasize in the book, non-religious or ideological dogma, because I think in some areas progress has been blocked by certainly not religious dogma, but ideology, especially in the field, for example, of regulation of genetically engineered plants and produce. Many who oppose that would not describe themselves as religious, but nonetheless they have this near obsession with so-called natural methods of food production, and I think that has presented an obstacle to a rational approach to policy in that area. So I definitely favor a secular approach to ethics generally, and certainly to bioethics. And in the chapter, it actually ties my different essays together in the book. Chapter 2 sets forth what I think is the proper approach to formulating public policy, and it relies exclusively on appeal to secular ethics, ethics that all people can discuss and evaluate without any appeal to religion.
We're talking with Ron Lindsay about his book, Future Bioethics, Overcoming Taboos, Myths, and Dogmas. Ron runs the Center for Inquiry in Washington, D.C., which is a humanist think tank, and this is Change Surfer Radio, and I'm Dr. Jay. Your point about food wars and food facts, food regulation is well taken, because there are many different kinds of ideological biases out there, and I tend to over-focus, probably, as many progressives do, on the ideological biases of religious right, but that's because, you know, they're the 900-pound gorilla in the room. Maybe if I was a European, you know, if I was in the Bundestag, I would be more worried about the Greens' biases than I would about the religious rights biases, but I happen to live under the thumb of Sarah Palinites in the United States, so...
Right, that's a point well taken. I think most of the opposition to progressive bioethics in the United States is based on religion, although not entirely. Again, depends on the issue, but you're quite right to point out, I think, that the religious right in particular has presented an obstacle. Or people who essentially rely on religious dogma, even if they don't say so. As you're probably aware, President Bush's bioethics council, when they first started, they actually made a point of saying that they were not going to rely on religious dogma. They were going to rely on people with expertise in secular ethics, which actually, to some extent, if you take it at face value, was a step forward from the Clinton administration's Commission on Bioethics, which unfortunately, at least I thought unfortunately, especially when they discussed the issue of cloning, which came up during the Clinton administration, actually called as witnesses representatives of various religious denominations. They had someone representing Protestant Christianity, the Catholic Church. They had an Islamic specialist. And at that time, I protested that, as many people did, because I just didn't see why religious bodies should be called upon to give testimony on a secular issue. And at least nominally, to its credit, President Bush's Bioethics Council didn't take that approach. But unfortunately, what has happened is, even though it's an anomaly, they haven't relied on religious dogma. Religious dogma has kind of snuck in anyway. So you have people like Leon Cass, who was the initial chairperson, later followed by Ed Pellegrino, both very conservative, both who throughout their career have relied a lot on religious dogma in shaping their views. So even if they didn't explicitly invoke religious dogma, the end result has been that you have religion influencing to a large extent the deliberations of President Bush's bioethics.
I mean, Cass and Pellegrino, they don't need, you know, I'd prefer to have an Episcopalian liberal pastor in there talking instead of these Aristotelian reactionaries who want to take us back to the 13th century or
further back. Yeah,
further back, 5th century BC.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the composition of President Bush's bioethics council is that it actually had very few bioethicists on there. I mean, Cass's training was as a medical doctor. Now, obviously, he has written a lot in bioethics and done scholarship in that area. But many of the members of the commission really had...
Charles Krauthammer was on the commission. I saw him yesterday in the newspaper defending these fascist Palinite mobs who were calling for Obama's death. And saying that was perfectly legitimate, and I'm just going, you're on the president's bioethics council. Yeah, right. Why?
Yeah, exactly. Why? I mean, there are people really who had no qualifications. Even people who were actually very intelligent and had expertise in their area, they didn't have expertise in bioethics. I mean, I'll give you one example. This person actually is someone who I regard as a personal friend. I knew him at Georgetown, Alfonso Gomez Lobo. Very intelligent person, very personable person, very nice guy to work with. But what's his expertise? His expertise is in classical Greek philosophy. So, I mean, if you wanted to talk about Plato with someone, he's your guy. And as I said, I think it'd be a very illuminating discussion if you wanted to talk about Plato or, as you say, Aristotle. But he actually probably would be the first to admit that before he was appointed to the council, he had very little background in bioethics. And that obviously has an effect on how they approach these issues. They approach these issues from certain conceptual frameworks that really have not been influenced by some of the bioethics literature and studies of the last few decades. And, you see the result in some of the policy statements and some of the books and publications that have been produced by the council.
Or this is why, ironically, people with my persuasion, what we call a techno-progressive, and my little micro-cultural niche techno-progressive persuasion, are often on the same page on a lot of issues with libertarians, is because at least with libertarians and people of the secular left, the presumption is that the state has to meet some kind of strong burden of proof before it interferes in people's right to control their own body, reproduction, and brain. And that logic does not start at all with that point with these kind of folks. The logic is, what kind of damage to vague generalities like human dignity and the value of community and things like that can we deduce from anything that's happening, and therefore it should be banned? That's the that's the entire logic. It has nothing to do with personal liberty. It's a pre-Enlightenment logic.
Oh, yes, exactly. I mean, and actually part of the problem with the whole kind of techno-conservative approach, if you will, is the reliance on what, at the end of the day, amounts to slogans. We've seen this in any improvement in the medical technology over the last few decades, and Leon Cass is notorious as someone who... was violently opposed to in vitro fertilization when it first came about and predicted it would dehumanize us and have other nefarious consequences. I mean, they rely a lot. I mean, the favorite argument we hear repeatedly ad nauseum is, oh, this new technology is unnatural. It can't be used because it's unnatural for human beings. That argument's been trotted out, as I said, when we had in vitro fertilization. It was first trotted out when we had organ transplants. Any advance in technology, especially if it seems to suggest some improvement in our well-being, is considered unnatural. And now, unfortunately, we have the same thing with genetically engineered or genetically modified plants. We have the same sort of instinctive, visceral reaction to any type of technology that would improve human capacities. As I said, this silly argument that someone's unnatural or... cognates of that somehow it's a violation of human dignity.
Let me,
which I agree, it's an empty term. I mean, if you're using a slogan, if you're trying to, make a speech and get people emotionally involved, maybe you use terms like that. But for any type of reasons analysis, you have to cash out. What does it mean to talk about human dignity? To me, and I think from what I'm hearing, you would tend to agree with this, what you really should be talking about is, are we interfering with individual choice? I mean, because if dignity means anything, presumably it means the dignity of the individual and the right and responsibility of the individual to make decisions about how to shape their own lives.
I quite liked your enhancement chapter, actually. I didn't mind, you have a couple things in there that I might have changed if I had written it myself. But I think you did a good job of parsing out the fact that there are irrational objections like the human dignity objections around enhancement. And then there are the important ones that we should take seriously, like equity, justice arguments and safety arguments, and that there are answers for those. And I think that that's absolutely right. There are ways to imagine a future in which we have various kinds of enhancements and have a just society at the same time. Let me skip over that for a second and go to what I found the most challenging about your book.
Okay.
It's your final observations, the concluding observation chapter about a theory of moral status. I don't know if you've ever seen the book I wrote, which is Citizen Cyborg. The central argument I make in Citizen Cyborg is that the thrust of Enlightenment ethics is the grounding of citizenship rights and a moral value, moral worth on psychological characteristics in particular personhood. I argue that that's a central theme. And you just take that and throw it right out the window in that chapter and argue for a completely situationally dependent or culturally determined or consequentially determined set of lines about where we're going to draw moral value and worth in society. I found that pretty troubling. Have other people, pushed back on that?
That has come up in conversations, and I think it's troubling because people seem to think, well, gee, that means we don't have any standards. It just depends on the situation of the time. And my response to that is, well, of course, ethics depends on the situation of the time. Now, the idea that somehow we need to look at certain intrinsic qualities, I certainly don't think that's unimportant, because if we're talking about people who are capable of engaging in moral reasoning, being moral agents, obviously you need to have a set of psychological capacities to do that. And that is relevant for determining moral status, but it's not determinative. And as I point out in the book, you also need to have certain circumstances, certain material conditions, in order to have a moral community. And that's something that tends to be overlooked. And fortunately, one reason we tend to overlook it is because we now do have a situation around the world where we can have at least some basis of trusting other people. I mean, trust is very important to have a moral community. We can have the expectation that no matter where we go in the world, more likely than not, certainly not always, we will be regarded as someone that has certain rights and certain responsibilities, and we can interact with people as we do nowadays on a regular basis. I mean, there are literally millions of transactions around the world, whether you send a fax to someone in Pakistan or do business with someone in China, you have certain expectations. That wasn't always the case, and one of the things I point out in my chapter is, although we tend to look at the past and talk about, gee, how barbaric people were when there were always these incessant wars and people tended to, if you were in the wrong tribe, that meant death for you. Certainly that is a situation that's not, ideal. On the other hand, we need to understand how people lived then. And how people lived, they lived in societies where there was little communication between different tribes, little understanding between different tribes. And as a result, essentially, a person in another tribe would not necessarily have moral status, nor, as I point out in the book, and I think this is what is controversial, would they necessarily deserve moral status. Because if, in fact, the point of morality is to enable us to live together, and I think morality is best viewed as a practical enterprise, I mean, unless it has an objective, what's the point of it?
Look,
I don't look at morality as a set of rules. It's a way to allow us to engage in cooperative activity. And there are certain conditions that have to be present for that cooperative activity to take place, and among them is the ability to communicate with others and to engage in a set of transactions with them and to be able to trust them.
Look, I don't deny that human morality is a product of a particular kind of biology, a particular set of cognitive capacities encoded in particular kinds of meat, particular kinds of societies and politics. I acknowledge all that. There's a social construction and biological construction to our values. And it's difficult to imagine how, with a robot or an extraterrestrial that didn't share a lot of that, we could construct a common moral and political universe. However, the Singer argument that with animals, for instance, you could say, you can make the claim that it's consistent with the values that we've developed in the Enlightenment to say, if you're going to treat a pig with a certain cognitive set of capacities in a certain way, then you shouldn't be treating a child with a certain set of, the same set of cognitive capacities a different way. That argument has been very compelling to me. And you sweep it aside in the book by saying, well, the kid's going to grow up into an adult and the pig never will. But this is precisely where perhaps the transhumanist perspective is important. The pig might, right? We now are a lot of kids don't, and the pig might. And so, to simply say human children or infants are morally different from animals because human kids grow up, they don't always.
Right. No, they don't always grow up. But I do think that there is a profound difference between animals and humans under current conditions. And that difference is that the majority of children do grow up to be beings with which we interact on a regular basis and have transactions and engage in social intercourse. And it's important simply to be able to live our lives, to be able to rely on how other people are going to act. And we try to inculcate moral values in our children so that they will act in reliable ways. And that's different with animals because I do make a distinction in my book, obviously, between animals that we have chosen to bring into our society, pets, or as they're sometimes called, companion animals. If one does that, obviously one assumes a moral responsibility for that animal. But there are many animals that are not part of society and will not be part of our society in the foreseeable future. You're right. Maybe at some point we'll have the technology to give a pig the ability to interact with us, and simply because the pig looks differently and may, you know, still walk differently and have different sort of bodily functions doesn't necessarily mean that animal should be excluded from a moral community.
No, well, but there
had to be certain material conditions, not just psychological capacities, that will entitle that being to be a part of the moral community.
Okay, but how about the great ape argument? I mean, great apes already display almost all of the relevant moral capacities and cognitive capacities that we consider relevant for moral reasons, and are at least as intelligent as three-year-old children. So how can we possibly exclude them from our moral community?
Well, again, as I point out, there are certain, when I say they're not part of the moral community, doesn't mean they don't have any moral status. And certainly, I think for any sentient being, we have an obligation to avoid cruel treatment, for example. I mean, the gratuitous infliction of pain, I don't think is morally justified. And most animals, perhaps not all animals, I'm not going to get into the neurobiology of, you know, insects or whatever, but let's just talk about mammals. They feel pain, and we should avoid trying to inflict pain. Likewise, it seems to me that to the extent we have interaction with them, and we do have interaction with some of the great apes, we need to respect their existence. They're not posing a threat to us. Certainly with their diminished numbers, they're not in competition for us in any meaningful sense for resources.
Okay, but let's rewind to your pain argument. Why is it that the capacity to experience pain is obliges us morally, and other cognitive capacities do not oblige us morally? You're saying that, you know, the fact that a New Guinean tribesman it can think and reason and has culture and everything like that doesn't oblige us morally because they can't communicate in our language and they can't email or text us. That doesn't make any sense to me. If you're also saying that the fact that a fish can experience pain gives us some moral obligation towards it, because that is a moral capacity.
It depends on how those cognitive capacities are manifested. Because in fact, as I point out in the hypothetical in the book, let's forget apes. Let's just say we have another species from another planet that perhaps, as far as we can tell, has the full panoply of cognitive capacities that we have. Nonetheless, if for whatever reason that species is determined to wipe us out, engages in centuries of incessant warfare with us, the idea that somehow we have a moral obligation to refrain from hurting them, even though they're determined to kill us, simply because they have the same cognitive capacities, I don't think it makes any sense. I mean, because again, the point of morality at a minimum is to ensure survival. It has a practical goal. Allow us to live together, and if in fact there is a set of beings that is determined not to live with us, then what is our moral obligation?
This has a direct parallel to our current situation in the war on terror. You could say, if people pose a threat to us, they're not part of our moral community. But instead, you could say, we're a part of a global world community that should have global world law, and there should be police that enforce that law. And if you pose a threat to your neighbors or to the civilization, then you can be punished, and in fact, you could be killed. There's a just war theory under that kind of a law. And that's a very different moral statement than to say, you don't bear any moral rights because you're outside of our moral community.
That's correct, because I believe that we are now at the point in human history that even for those who wage war, there are institutions in place that regulate how that warfare is to be conducted and what happens with combatants who happen to be captured. So if, in fact, yes, there's an immediate threat, you take what measures are necessary to prevent that threat, and that may result in the person being killed who's posing the threat. If that person is disarmed or disabled in some way, doesn't necessarily imply that you kill that person. You may be put in detention for a while. That person has certain rights, and we can determine how that person should be dealt with, you know, depending on how the situations are adjudicated. But again, that's against the background of human institutions that have been developed over the past few centuries, if not millennia. If you put yourself in a situation, again, you can either take my science fiction example or the example of how humans lived 20 or 30,000 years ago, where there were not these institutions, and you simply had warring tribes, how do you deal with a tribe that is determined to annihilate you, that doesn't have the same respect for rules, will not, you know, if they're captured in some way, will do everything they can not to cooperate with you, will maybe commit suicide, will try everything they can do to undermine you. It's, you know, you're assuming a background, which, again, it's not like I'm saying we shouldn't have these institutions. I'm very happy we live in a world where we have these institutions that allow us to regulate conduct in a less violent way than we did in prehistory. But if you don't have those institutions, the idea that somehow you have a moral obligation to beings that under no circumstance will be able to live with you cooperatively, I think is a mistake. And I think we tend to ignore that because, again, happily, and I emphasize this is a good thing, happily we live in a world where we have the background institutions that allow us to regulate conduct essentially among all human beings in a way that allows human beings to have moral status, moral status. And again, for animals, I think animals have partial moral status, but the fact is that most animals are not integrated into our society.
Well, when the alien overlords come, I'm going to tell them that you said that they could be tortured because they weren't signatories to the Geneva Convention. But otherwise,
Well, if they want to be signatories, we should try that. I'm certainly not saying we should make an effort to deal with other beings peacefully. But again, the example I have in my book is where we have centuries of warfare with these beings I call the spores, and who seem to have all our cognitive capacities, but nonetheless, nothing we do seems to be able to persuade them to deal with us in any type of cooperative manner. To say that they're part of our moral community would be, I think, essentially consigning us to suicide. I mean, why we would do that? And again, the minimum condition for any moral community, for any successful moral community, is a set of moral norms that ensures the survival of the moral community. Because the idea that somehow we have to follow a rule that's abstract, that nonetheless will lead to our destruction, I think, frankly, doesn't make any sense.
I agree with the conclusion. I'm not sure about how you get there and about its relationship to moral standing. But unfortunately, we're at the end of the half hour. I've been speaking with Ron Lindsay. He's a doctorate in bioethics and a JD. He runs the Center for Inquiry in Washington, D.C., which is a leading humanist think tank in the entire world. And he's written this wonderful book, Future Bioethics, Overcoming Taboos, Myths, and Dogmas. I want to thank you for joining us today, Ron.
Thanks so much for having me. And let me just add quickly that the views I express in the book and in this interview are my personal views and should not necessarily be regarded as the views of the Center for Inquiry. Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. Our opening and closing music was composed and recorded by Ricardo Campa. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.